The theme for today is ritual and religion. So I suppose, first of all, what language that in any kind of consideration, we must remember that language is very personal. So language isn't a kind of, there's nothing absolute about language. And we must be careful that we are in common agreement around language, because I can be using the word religion and you can be hearing it from your perception of what that word is, and we can have a disagreement because we just have a different perception of that very word. So the word religion itself, a lot of people come and ask, is Buddhism a religion? And some say, oh, it's not a religion, it's a philosophy, or it's a way of life, oh yes, it is a religion. And then you get people having an argument about whether it's a religion or not, right? So you have to sort of come to some common agreement of about what that word might mean for you. So even if one disagrees, if one at least knows what the other person means by the word religion, then we know what they're saying. So for some people, the word religion implies is a negative word. So for some people, it implies dogma. A dogma which is perhaps inflexible and doesn't admit or include other kinds of philosophies. This is the kind of negative way of looking at it. That it implies somehow separation, separates people, alienates people from other traditions. That it's responsible for more wars that have ever been, you know, this is a sort of negative way of looking at religion. The positive way, or the way I like to use the word religion, is from the roots of it, religio. Ligio is the same word that is used for ligament, and so the ligaments bind together the leg, make the movement of the leg possible. Religio, to rebind, and to bind to something for a purpose. In the sense, in the case of the leg, it's for the purpose of movement. In the case of our human development, it's for some kind of realization. For me, religion is a positive word because it implies that there is a possibility in human consciousness of some deep realization, something very profound, not just simply mundane happiness, but something profound, and that there are ways and systems to realize that. So when people ask me, is Buddhism a religion, in that positive sense, I certainly think so. Because for me, Buddhism is more than humanism. It includes humanism. It's more than a philosophy, just a system of thought. It is a way of living in practice, but it does have a goal. It does have the realization of profound freedom and peace, nibbana. So for now, for you, whatever that word might mean to you, religion, please remember that I'm not talking about, if I'm talking in the positive sense, I'm not just talking about hanging on to a dogma and arguing my dogma against your dogma, my dog fighting your dog. It's not that for me. And not to say that people who say they're Buddhists don't become dogmatic. I'm not saying that all Buddhists are angels and are totally open and so on. That's not it. If a person uses a knife to cut their hand rather than cut the bread, it's not the knife's fault. So certainly, so-called religious people can be very, I guess the ugliest form of that would be the sort of fundamentalism, where we're right and everyone else is wrong, where people get this kind of garrison mentality, cultish mentality, which is terribly alienating for themselves and others. All that kind of stuff I call superstition. To me, that's not religion, you know, in the sense that I like to use that word. Ritual, and the word ritual is for me, that denotes a certain activities that are done in a repeated way, in a similar pattern, in similar times of day, of the week, of the month, of the year, that uses symbols and images, uses all kinds of body language, uses various kinds of instruments for fulfilling the ritual. So we say, like, he has, you know, someone has a ritual cup of tea, cigarette, and reads the time in the morning. To me, that's not a religious ritual. That's not ritual in religion. That's ritual in the kitchen or whatever. Okay? So then for me, a ritual in religion would imply something that is is an aid, is a tool, is a reminder, is some kind of contemplative form that helps us to practice religion, that helps remind us of religion, of religious values. So when a ritual goes off, it's when it becomes superstitious, when it doesn't uplift my mind, but when I have to do it in a certain way, and if I don't do that, I will somehow get some kind of penalty, like go to hell or be punished or whatever. And then that's, again, for me, superstition. So rituals, even in a good tradition, can become superstitious very quickly. So, again, if someone uses a knife to stab themselves, it's not the knife's fault. If someone takes a ritual and then uses it and obsesses with it and becomes fearful with it, then that's, to me, not the true nature of ritual or the true use of ritual in a religious sense. Say in Asia, you have a ritual. When in Sri Lanka, you have a ritual that when food is offered to a samana, a monastic, it should be offered with both hands. That's a gesture of respect, right, Rookie? Okay. So, I was once in New Zealand, and we were having a meal at a person's home, and the elderly lady who was inviting us for the meal, her son was there. Her son was very keen Buddhist. I think he was one of the committee members of the association, very dedicated, very good-hearted, very mindful man. He offered me a plate of cashew nut curry with one hand. And his mother blasted him. He went back to the kitchen and said, "You only offered it with one hand. You didn't offer it with two hands. Don't you know how to do it right? Nya, 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 nya." That's superstition. It's also a hassle, but it's superstition. So something which is designed to create mindfulness. And one of the basic religious practices of Buddhism is mindfulness, awareness, to be aware. So Sri Lanka has developed this lovely kind of gesture of offering things with two hands. But then someone sees, well, you must offer to monks with two hands or you don't get any merit points. So it's bad karma if you offer with one hand, and then it goes on, and the person offers with one hand, and it gets all sticky, messy, and people say, "I hate religion because it's so uptight, and it causes all these problems. Why can't we just be relaxed?" And that is one of the problems with ritual, is that it loses humor. It becomes humorless. You must do it right. If we do it wrong, and then fear and superstition and so on. But that's not an aid in contemplation. That's not a support in contemplation. It's not religious. It's what human beings do with this. So I always try to keep in mind that attitude towards ritual. Let it be something which is a support for the contemplative life, a support to inspire the mind. Let it be something which informs our lives at certain times of the year of the spiritual life, of spiritual practices. If I keep that in mind, then if I start to get uptight about the way something is done, I see how silly that is, because the whole point of Buddhism is not to be uptight. so So I'd say I can only speak of Buddhist rituals. I haven't really practiced in other traditions. I can have opinions about the mass or about Islamic bowing and so on and so forth, but I've never practiced it. And I think to really understand the ritual of a tradition, you have to do it to get a sense of feeling it, how it actually affects you. What does it actually do for you? So say one of the rituals that we are involved in Buddhist monasticism and with the laity is that we chant blessing chants. These are ancient Pali chants, which most of you have heard. And we chant them on occasions of rites of passage, birth, blessing of marriage, blessing of birth, things like that. We also chant them when someone is very ill. I had a good example of how that actually works as a support in contemplation. When I was in New Zealand, we had a kind of Brazilian New Zealand woman who had battled with cancer for about 6 years. Very brave woman. Her body was just lacerated with all kinds of scars from the operations that she had endured. And I had been going in the last weeks of her life, I'd been going to hospice to visit her and try to support her and encourage her. And then in about 24 hours before she died, the cancer entered into the bones and it started to dissolve and go into her bloodstream. I think that's the correct medical thing which was happening. Please correct me if doctors here. But anyway, the result is that her mind became very confused. And then I was speaking to her. I said, oh, just try to relax, accept things the way they are, the kind of way we talk. She couldn't compute. Her mind just couldn't receive intellectual information, which before, easy, you know, she'd talk to her and she'd remember and she'd kind of relax. And so then, what am I going to do now? And just watch. And then I just started, just kind of spontaneously, just to start to do chanting. Now, she was in a very, you know, it was physically painful, but also you could see the mental agitation around that was very strong. So I started to do chanting. Now, the thing about this chanting is that she had been doing it and hearing it for the last, she had been going to the monastery for 7 years. So she really knew this chanting. And as I started to do the chanting, I could see that she just started to calm down. And it wasn't me, you know, not because I'm kind of a magician, but it was rather that her mind associated the ritual of chanting with letting go, relaxing, be at peace with the way things are. Because it had been that kind of support for contemplation, that kind of aid in contemplation for 7 years. So the result then in her mind obviously was very wholesome, because it reminded her of that possibility of even in difficulties of how to relax and accept the way things are. A very good lesson for me, how that actually worked. So if one then cultivates rituals in this way for a lifetime, the idea of cultivating it is not something which gives you a result in time. In other words, if I do this ritual now, then, you know, in 5 years' time, I'm going to get the goods, the result. That to me is still superstition, because the religious insight is timeless. For me, the religious insight is something here and now, beyond time. Because time and self are coexistent. In other words, the sense of me as an ego always arises in time. What am I going to do tomorrow? What did I do in the past? But the spiritual realization is something here and now. And so, for me, ritual, the important thing of ritual is that it awakens the mind in the here and now. It's not supposed to, like, I feel, oh gosh, I'm not going to be able to, I might flunk that exam, so I better go give the monks a meal, and then I'll pass the exam. That's somewhat superstitious, but it's probably better than taking Valium. You know, so although we can put down the rituals of other countries, sometimes actually they can be very, very useful in the way of dispelling fear. But in the whole way of transcendence and the kind of deeper implications of the religious life, what a ritual for me should be doing it should be bringing me in some sense to the silence of the mind, to the mind which is empty of ego striving, the mind which is not bound by the whole sense of me becoming something, going somewhere, trying to get rid of something, but the timeless kind of essence of a spiritual life, the timeless knowing of things as they are, which is silent. It's not an intellectual knowing, it's silence, it's deep stillness. So when rituals do that, I feel that they are religious in that sense. Now the ritual can do it for me, I have to do it myself, don't I? In some sense I have to use that ritual to remind myself of that stillness. So rituals also become habit. You notice we bow a lot here, and we bow three times, and you know, the kind of attitude after a while is, I'll just whip three quick ones down and have my meal, right? Mm-hmm. Bang, 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 and you're done your three and you're ready to eat. So, so that's again, you see, I mean, you gotta do it. I mean, you have to bring forth that, you have to use the aid in the proper way, the support for contemplation. Mm-hmm. So like traditionally we have bowing. We bow to our teachers, we bow to Buddha images, and again, the bowing, say for us, it's a ritual. It's using body language in a ritualistic kind of way. And the challenge there is to actually do it and make the mind silent. Now you can see if that would be my view to ritual, that I'm going to try to use this to silence my mind, then each time in the monastery, and that's what we do a lot here, if I really use it that way, then it's incredibly helpful. You know, I come in and I've just been on the telephone and dealing with mail and faxes and people's stuff, and then I'm all, my mind's sort of racing away, and I come in and I stop and I bow carefully three times. That's an aid in contemplation. If I think, well, if I don't bow, you know, I'm not a good monk, that's ego. You know, I'm a terrible person for not bowing, and other people look at me, you terrible thing, you didn't bow. You know, then that's not it either. So it can be an aid in contemplation if it's used that way. So if our life is punctuated in that way, you know, day in and day out, on a daily basis, on a yearly basis, monthly basis, if we have these kind of things which remind us, then you do get this chance of breaking through the busyness of the mind and coming to the silence of the mind in so many different kinds of ways. That's very powerful, they're very helpful. Say rituals use imagery, icons. So we have the Buddha image, don't we? We have these Buddha images. Now, say we have that standing Buddha out there. Now, I was watching, or was a walking Buddha. I was sitting back in this room the other day, and I was just looking out to the grounds, and there was a man and a woman, and they were walking by the Buddha image, and when they came close to the Buddha image, they were Asian, I think they were Thai, they stopped and they put their hands in Anjali with a kind of sense of respect, and then they walked by. During the children's summer camp, I was walking and there were a couple of six-year-olds in front of me, and the six-year-old, one of them said to the other one, "Did you see the ugly face on that Buddha? I couldn't believe it. Did you see the size of its nose? Come on, I'll show you. Look, you wouldn't believe this thing." They were really sweet. I mean, really great. And so they dragged them over and said, "Hey, look at that thing." So there is, in some people's minds, there is a sort of looking at imagery in an aesthetic sense. You know, so you look at image not as a, as an icon, as a support for contemplation, but as you know, whether I like it or not aesthetically. But that's not using it in a religious sense. Certainly, a beautiful image might be more, you know, if might be a more helpful support for that kind of religious contemplation. But like using a Buddha image, if you use a Buddha image properly, go up to that Buddha image over there and you look at it, and your mind might say, "God, what a schnoz hole on that thing. Can you believe the face? Why do they get better sculpture around here? My gosh, I don't know." Now, if you are listening to that, you're listening to that mind, and you just keep looking, and then you bring the mind to silence, and you just see, well, this is just the way it is. you awaken to the way things are, and you've used it as a support for contemplation, bringing you to silence. If you look at it and you just get caught in the aesthetic sense, and you kind of complain and blah, 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 and then just walk on, then there's no religion in that. And then each time you see it, if you see it in that religious sense, it brings, oh, silence. But if you're looking at an aesthetic sense, oh, I don't like that one. It's terrible. Why don't they get rid of this? So you can spend 10 years walking by that thing and thinking, why don't they get rid of it or make your mind silent? You see the kind of possibilities there. So all the imagery that we have, first of all, one has to, you know, kind of, you know, accept the use of it. And now this isn't necessary. Rituals are not necessary. Imagery is not necessary. But they can be very, very, very helpful. And in a secular society, I think one of the impoverishments of a secular society is that there's very little imagery which brings us to that religious sense. Church spires is about what we have. We have lots of adverts for Johnny Walker and whoever or whatever, but those aren't really, you know, they're aids in consumerism, sure. They're supports for consumption and greed, but they're not supports for the religious sense. And I think that is a great kind of poverty in a culture which has no symbols to remind us of spiritual aspiration. A culture also has like rites of passage. These are very important. So birth, marriage, taking of vows, taking up a vocation, death, you know, different kinds of things which we as human beings feel are very significant, don't we? We often want to do something. I once asked someone in the States, what's the rite of passage for an adolescent male in North America? One person said getting a car. Another person said getting a gun. Which is very macho kind of way of rite of passage. In traditional Buddhist society, one way of, say, for an adolescent male, one rite of passage was to ordain for 3 months, to do a retreat, to have some kind of religious ritual to remind one of what one's duty is as an adult male, from adolescence to adulthood. I feel, now, in Thailand, the monks tended to de-emphasize ritual, because in places like Thailand there is a lot of superstition around rituals because people haven't delved deeply into it, and so there's a necessity to play it down. They say, well, don't worry about the sprinkling of water, why don't you meditate for 5 minutes or keep the precepts. I had a Cambodian man once in New Zealand came to me and he wanted me to sprinkle holy water on his car. I said, why? He said, well, I had an accident. I said, have you got a driver's license? so there was a kind of good luck quality about that. And again, that's probably better than Valium. But I think, say, in a Western culture, I find that I'm really grateful for my upbringing in Thailand as a young monk, as it were, that I realize that we can introduce rituals into a Buddhist culture in England, but also keep them alive by trying to explain their value and trying to use them as supports for contemplation, for the religious life. So I find it a very kind of an enrichment of my own life as a monk and as a person who relates in these times of death and birth. I find it very, very helpful. You say, like say Princess Diana's funeral. That was a rite of passage. And I thought it was beautifully done, and it was very there was a great sense of beauty about it, and composure and dignity and heart also. And then I thought, now that's the richness of a culture, when a culture has that kind of a form that can be enacted. It can carry the whole society in a time of grief and bring up very wholesome emotion, very wholesome mind states, because I think England was much more compassionate for that. I hope so. I certainly felt that. So that's an aid in the religious life, isn't it? when we have some kind of a ceremony which allows us to feel something like grief. And this is, say, like with funerals, one of the functions, I think, of a funeral is to bring forth grief. And then to somehow point to grief as a Dhamma, as a part of our human existence, rather than just keep it at the personal level of my personal loss. And if there is a form for that, and say, in our chanting and the various things that we do in a Buddhist funeral, then it's an incredibly good vehicle for that, for the whole family, for anyone involved. When all these stories from New Zealand, but when I was in New Zealand, there was a lovely elderly couple lived next to the monastery, and they weren't Buddhists, but we were very, very friendly. And the elderly gentleman had a heart attack and basically dropped dead in the front door of the house. And these people weren't very connected to the church, and I kind of regret that I didn't say, well, why don't we do the funeral in the monastery, because I didn't want to, because they weren't Buddhists, I didn't quite know how to play that one. But anyway, they got a funeral celebrant, which is a person, I don't know if you have this in England now, but you have a person who is of no particular religious denomination and does a kind of funeral service. And because these people had no tradition, they didn't quite know what to tell the funeral celebrant. And I went to the funeral, I just watched, and it was so pathetic, it was so dead, and so lacking in heart, and they didn't really have a chance to communicate, and they were all kind of sitting in their chairs, not knowing what to do, and I found that a kind of a lost opportunity, a real lost opportunity where something could be done and expressed in a beautiful way. Now, I've been to traditional Buddhist funerals, which also can be very kind of dead, because people just go through the motions. You know, they think they have to do the funeral in the right way, and nothing is maybe emphasized about the mind coming to some deeper form of contemplation. So also say, like, in a Buddhist tradition, what we try to do is, like, say, rites of passage, like, say, birth. We try to, if we have a ceremony around that, to actually talk about what is the responsibility of the family for the spiritual upbringing of this child? What's the spiritual responsibility with this child? So here's something where a group of people, a family, even if they're not very much engaged with the monastery, because they do want to do something special. This is special. Birth is special. This being special. Then it's a chance to say what makes it really special is some sense of religious aspiration. And to introduce that into a culture, the culture of that family, to introduce that enriches that culture. But if you don't have that, I think, if you don't have that, then again there's a kind of poverty, not having that. I was, I was recently in Eastern Europe, and I had a chance to witness what the Soviets have done to the people in those countries, in the Baltic states, and the Soviets, from kind of Stalin's example, had this kind of ability to rip out the heart of a culture. So in Mongolia, they killed like 10,000 monks and, you know, made the monasteries into whatever, to store wheat or to do building work. And they kind of just ripped out the heart of the culture, took away all the rituals, took away the rites of passage. And when we do that, when that happens to a culture, it dies. It becomes this very kind of negative, depressed thing. And you see that with the American Indians, you see it with the Maori people in New Zealand. Yeah. And I had a chance to witness that, and I showed some slides yesterday, but there was there's a group of people called the Livonians on the Baltic coast of Latvia who are actually related to the Estonians more, and there's a very small group of people, 200 people left, and they were fishing folk that had a lot of ritual around fishing. And when the Soviets occupied that, they forbade any kind of fishing on their coast because there was a lot of military shipping going on. And so they dragged their fishing boats up into the shore about a kilometer, and then they forbid these people to fish. Now, their whole life, a lot of their life was around fishing. The rituals, the kind of celebrations during the year was around fishing. One of the rituals they had was they would cremate a ship which was no longer useful. They weren't allowed to do that. So there was the ship graveyard with trees growing out of these old rotting ships. Fishing boats. And near these fishing boats was a car with four men sitting in it who were drunk out of their heads. Just completely, they were alcoholics. They were finished as human beings. And I could see what they had no substance in their life. They could probably get enough food and all that, but they had no meaning. There was no purpose. There were no rituals. There was no spirituality. There was just this vacuum. And what did they fill it with, of course, was schnapps, vodka, and beer. And that was very sad to see that. Very sad. Consumer culture has the danger of that too, doesn't it? The danger of replacing something timeless with the culture of shopping. So the kind of ritual that this culture gets, not maybe I think we're more spiritual, but the shopping culture gets into is the shopping, is the ritual. It's the kind of, once I was told that the freedom in America is the freedom to shop. Shop until you drop, you know, that kind of language. But that is always bound in time, isn't it? When I get this thing, then I'll be happy. But that is not, you know, that's not ritual in religion. And that leads to a very kind of a depressing way of life, because there's no kind of real aspiration there. Now the thing about, for me, the thing about religion is that it is a very optimistic thing for me, because I take my insights into religion come from Buddhism, and for me Buddhism is very optimistic in the sense that it says that in human consciousness there is this incredible opportunity. There is this incredible possibility called enlightenment, compassion, wisdom. And so part of ritual is to inspire the mind, to uplift the mind, to remind oneself of the spiritual aspiration. And we need that, because life can sometimes really press us down. You know, it can seem so hopeless and sometimes just so boring or whatever. So we have like celebrations, don't we? So in Buddhism we celebrate Vaisak, we celebrate the life of the Buddha, his enlightenment and Parinibbana. In our monastic order, we kind of celebrate the end of the rains retreat by coming together. We celebrate the first sermon of the Buddha. Different ways that we contemplate that. And we use the Buddha image, we use the life of the Buddha, and we have certain chants that we do related to the Buddha. Now all of that, especially if it's done in a large group, can be very powerful. With some of the chanting I've done in Thailand, you know, like at times maybe there are like 400 monks or so on, and then just we get one of the chants going that we've all been doing, and it kind of raised the stubble on my head. We get this kind of thrill up the spine of joy and inspiration. And that really carries. That really carries in the religious life, because much of the religious life is a hard slog. You know, going through one's greed, hatred, delusion, despair, and the pathetic states of mind that we all have to endure. So something like that, if you have celebratory rituals, which when a large number of people come together and they celebrate the life of the Buddha, say, and you do that, then that carries you in the practice. But again, if there are no rituals, if there are no celebrations in that sense, then Buddhism can become sort of brain surgery without anesthesia. You're just always looking at the mind, looking at your stuff, and just trying to meditate, and you're falling asleep, and you're trying to keep the precepts, you can't do that. And it seems just hard work all the time. But to come together for celebration. But not in the sense of just kind of heedlessly getting drunk. You know, it's not like having a party and getting completely annihilated. That's annihilation, yeah. That's not celebration. But in a religious sense, celebration is celebrating. You know, bringing up the fact that there are enlightened beings, that this is our possibility, that we're not, like human beings, aren't just kind of a grubby, selfish, planet-polluting things. That there's more to human cult or to human beings than that. And so the whole life of celebration, and a traditional Buddhist society has that. Again, and you can see, if you take out those celebrations, or if those celebrations are simply, you know, like, you celebrate the victory of someone winning a gold medal in the Olympics. It's nice. But But it's not a ritual in a religious sense, is it? It's just sort of whippee, we won, but then we have to win again. Now the thing about rituals is they're done in repeated patterns, aren't they? You do the same thing again and again and again, on a daily basis, like we have every full moon, every half moon, every new moon, we have the rituals of like an observance day, a Sabbath. Now this, in many religions have had this kind of sense of a day of rest. The Judaic tradition has that very strongly. The Christian tradition used to have it maybe, the idea of Sunday, the day of rest. And Buddhists have the observance day. In Northeast Thailand, where I, say, trained as a monk in my early days, in especially Ajahn Chah's monasteries, the lay people would come the morning of the observance day, they'd come early and they'd offer food and the monks would do chanting, then there would be a discourse and the lay people would just be in the monastery, just stay in the monastery all day till, many of them till the following dawn, and they'd do an all-night vigil with the monastic community. And now, not that many would do that, certainly not the majority of the population. But some of the people that did that, say, especially some of the women, they were incredibly strong meditators with these really lovely kind of motherly hearts, gentle hearts, you know. It was a beautiful combination. This incredible kind of compassion and yet real strength in the meditative life. And I could see some of them had been doing that since they were kids. They go to temple, they take the precepts, they offer food, they hear Dhamma, they meditate for 12 hours. Every fortnight or every week. Every week, every fortnight. Now, the thing, now that's kind of ritualistic because it's repeated. And the same thing. And our society tends to like new things and interesting things. Notice that rituals, we don't try to rearrange them to make them interesting. I've noticed, especially young monks, quite often they say, oh God, this chanting is boring. Can't we have a bit of Tibetan? Or the Hindu bhajans are really nice, you know, or maybe something from Elton John or something interesting. That's, of course, that's the mind which wants excitement. Now, rituals are not exciting. If you don't put effort in a ritual, it puts you to sleep, doesn't it? You know, God, there's that chanting again, and I'm bowing, God, I have to do this. And so the mind which doesn't want to be uplifted, or doesn't know how to uplift it, if we don't know how to uplift ourselves with these things, then they are boring and they are useless and maybe better not do them. But if the person doesn't know how to use the knife, it's not the knife's fault. Right? So the thing about ritual is that it tends to be very repeated. It's a repeated pattern. And again, like my ordination, when we bring men or women into the order, the format of that chanting is to some, you know, it's very similar to probably what happened in the Buddha, in the end of the Buddha's life, probably. Certainly it's the same pattern in Thailand going on for many hundreds of years. Same pattern again and again and again. A group of people coming together and doing this very, very ritualized thing. And you know, why not just say, well, okay guys, do we want this guy to be a monk? Yeah, okay, go for it, he's a monk. Put a robe on him, shave his head, all right, mate, you're a monk. That'd be awful, wouldn't it? It'd be just sort of sloppy, at least. But when you have a ritual, and you actually prepare for it, and you, if I'm speaking to the junior monks, say, you know, this is what your responsibilities would be, this is your aspiration, this is your discipline, this is the way you live, and so on. And one contemplates that, and one brings the idea of aspiration forward, and does that for many months before the ritual, and then one makes a determination, okay, I'm going to do it, I'm going to try to be a monk for a few years. Then that has a very powerful effect on the mind. In Thailand, they say, Buat Ngai Suk Ngai, which means if you ordain easy, disrobe easy. Huh? That certainly must be true of marriage and things like that. I'm not, you know, I don't know about marriage, but I know about commitment. And if commitment isn't somehow maybe ritualized, but not as a you know, just not just a formula to go through, but as a way of bringing up intention and bringing forth that, say, marriage or whatever it is a spiritual vehicle. It's not just a vehicle for mutual comfort and that, which it also is for mutual happiness, but it's actually a vehicle for the spiritual life. And then there's a determination to use that vehicle. A ritual can do that. And so sometimes, you know, some of the rituals, like the ritual of becoming a monk, I only do one time this lifetime. Yeah. Don't do it twice. Don't have to do it kind of every week. So then you make that more special. Make it very powerful, very important. We've often talked about how can we give adolescents rites of passage? I don't know myself. How could you give young men some kind of aspiration rather than a car and a new CD player? Something a bit more profound than that. And this is what a culture considers. How do we bring forth the spiritual life into the daily things that we do? For lay life, you see, a monastery is actually designed for this kind of thing. Obviously, we have the icons, we have all the forms where we come together, the bowing, the chanting, and so it's really designed for awakening that way. In lay life, of course, you haven't got that set up, and you have to do your own design work. You have to create your own rituals. You can use Buddhist rituals, but you have to create the times and situations in your life if you find that helpful. And it can be helpful. So one of the things that is very helpful is in Buddhism is a shrine. Is some place in the house which is respected, which has a Buddha image, which has candles, incense and flowers. Candles represent wisdom, so it's the light which dispels darkness. Flowers represent moral purity, the beauty of the flower. Also, sometimes flowers represent the idea of change. That which is beautiful also fades. Two meanings. And incense represents meditation, the sweetness of the mind which is calmed. Candles, incense, flowers, a Buddha image. Now, say, if one creates that in one's environment, so all the rooms in our monastery, every monk and nun would have that kind of a shrine. Unfortunately, because of fire regs, we can't light candles or incense. But that's just a minor point. But if one actually uses that, and then one uses that space for meditation, one has that image, one uses that space, then that becomes associated with calm. The activity that you do, the imagery that you use, is a very, it's like a memory tool. It reminds one of silence, of the religious aspiration. So that can be very, very helpful. And then the idea of a Buddhist shrine is to care for it, to dust it, to keep the flowers fresh, to take the candle wax off the table or whatever needs to be done. So there's a sense of respect and mindfulness around that. In our monastery, we try to encourage everyone when they come into the room to bow to their shrine. Does anyone have any questions then, or comments from their own experiences? How you use ritual or whatever? Or the word religion?
Does change as it really becomes
Yeah, like, I think, you see, like we do now, we do chanting in English and Pali, and some we just do in English. There's that kind of change. But I think where the change, the challenge is continually redefining it. That's more the challenge. Because like I've seen groups that they don't want Buddha images, they just want the Dhamma. You know, we don't want this Buddhist stuff, I just want Dhamma. And then I hear about them 20 years later, they're trying to invent rituals. You know, so they want to create an ordination. So they create some kind of ordination. Okay. And then people are getting married, better do something about that. So you know, they're kind of reinventing the wheel, which is okay, because it might make it very alive for them. But I think the challenge is to define it, continually redefine it, because it so easily goes into superstition and things like that. And so it's getting that freshness of mind into it. I've kind of like, dabbled with other traditions and tried to introduce them here and there, but it's never felt quite right, you know. And I always tend to come back to the simple things that we have here. But then I'm not a very kind of, I'm not very creative in that sense. I'm not into song and dance maybe or something, I don't know. But so you will find maybe some monks and nuns who are maybe more creative and do bring things in. And the whole community might kind of agree upon that. But the development of a religion is like I was saying earlier, that the way a culture evolves is not genetically. You know, it's through communication is the way a culture evolves. And that evolution takes time, takes usually quite a long time. And I am wary of fads, because I've seen so many fads in the last 20 years, psychological fads and chanting fads and meditative fads and so on. So there is that danger. So the things that tend to last are things that, you know, are deeply considered, and then they're tried out slowly, and then they have a good feeling about them, and then they kind of naturally evolve into it. And there's that kind of experimentation quite often that's going on in kind of subtle ways. There's one example I forgot to give of a person who was using ritual symbols in the wrong way. There was I think it was a Thai woman, had one of these Buddhist medallions, these little icons that they wear in Thailand and Burma and in Cambodia, and it had been blessed by some famous monk, so it had power. And so she carried it around, it had power. She went swimming and lost it. Then she came to me, I've fallen into hell. So that, you know, that was just a classic example of using it completely wrong. So from that, which was powerful for her, obviously if you think you've got a power object, you're going to lose that eventually. And if you lose that, of course, you just drop into hell. So she was, I tried to explain to her what the difference between, what a symbol is actually about. But her mind was so superstitious, it was really hard to get her out of that kind of mold.
It's very interesting, because it's something that I was thinking about, perhaps not so extreme as that, but if you rely on any kind of ritual, even if you do it knowing it's only ritual, because it has that therapeutic value in a way, even if you just look at it very scientifically, this ritual, like you say, something you had given, like that lady who was dying, and simply because it was something familiar to her, took her to a place of safety in a way, and she became calm. But even to a chanting, you can say, be very ill, and you lost your voice, and you can't chant.
No, I was chanting.
Sorry?
She wasn't chanting. But it's an aid, it's not, if you attach to it, yeah. But I think you tend to throw out the baby with the bathwater. You know, just because it can be an attachment, it doesn't mean it has to be. No, I don't think so. No, not for me. I can be outside the monastery for months and not have any kind of ritual around, and I, you know, the practice is still strong. So it's more a joyous thing for me. You know, it's not kind of a needy thing. If someone asks me, do you find that you need rituals more and more, or does that need fall away? But for me, it was a kind of wrong kind of question, because when I came in, I thought, what is all this ritual about? I just want to meditate, you know. And now I love it. And it's not so much need, it's joy. It's because you got to do something with your mind and body. And it's lovely to use it in that kind of ritual way. You know, like, because there is body language, it's there, and why not use it in kind of expressive ways? Otherwise, it can be very, very passive kind of thing, you just sit and watch kind of thing. But you have a body, you have voice, there is language, all these things are there. Why not use them for expression? And then there is that expressive part, celebration, and so on. So I would, yeah, but it's the attachment's the problem. I definitely agree with that. But the implication that all ritual implies attachment, I wouldn't agree with that. That's too absolute for me. Yeah, that would be too absolute. Yes, sir.
It seems to me that ritual can be a hindrance rather than an aid, unless a person, first of all, gets into the way of what you call mindfulness. As a non-conformist, as a youth, everything that was ritualistic was barred, because that was taking away the real truth, as it were. Now, I'm not suggesting that was right, but I'm wondering how one avoids this if young people are brought up with the rituals, how you get through to them that this is only an aside. The real thing is to be mindful of what you're doing and what life is about.
Well, you teach the rituals in the way of mindfulness. You know, you actually instruct a person how to bow and bring the mind to silence. If the initial instruction is, if you don't bow, you don't get enlightened, mate, then that's not going to work. But if you actually, the initial instruction is, okay, bowing is using the body this way and being really, really mindful of the body language, of what the body feels like, and to do it in a particular kind of way and do it mindfully, then the initial instruction is around mindfulness. So that's all right. I think, like, we live in a very cynical culture, you know, so and cynicism can sometimes have a lot of conceit behind it, so that we tend to somehow, because that's our viewpoint, that's our perspective. But that, I mean, obviously that's like Westerners, they're not into ritual for, I mean, they don't buy that kind of stuff at all. You couldn't even hope to tell a person if you bow you're going to get enlightened, and no one's going to believe that in this culture. So actually what you have to get people past is cynicism. Say, I don't have to bow, I'm a meditator. So, you know, like with I think with Asian people you have to get them past the superstition. With Westerners you have to get them past the conceit. You know, I don't need to bow. This stuff. I'm better than this. Those Asians, they bow. You get a lot of that, you know. I just want Dharma. And you just hear the conceit behind it. So each culture is going to have its own sort of conditioning, and these issues won't, they're not like, you see, they're not absolutes, are they? They're kind of in a cultural context, in the kind of conditioning that we've received from our families and so on. But I know, most Westerners, I went to Thailand, the only reason I bowed is because I had to do it. All right, I'll do it, okay. Grumble, 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 bow, bow, bow. It was a really kind of joyless way to do it. And then someone kind of, you know, began to tell what it was about and helped me.
Properly, I mean, it's very difficult to do something that you do all the time regularly, not for it not to become a habit.
But what is the basic habit we have is I thoughts. And that habit's going on all the time. How do you break that one? You can say, this person bows and it's habitual, but when you look at your own mind, you know, there's something habitual usually going on, like worry, self-disparagement, judgment, and that's going on all, you know, kind of moment by moment by moment. So to say that it can easily become habitual, to say, what isn't habitual? How much of a person's life is actually mindful? So that's one question. So then you see, actually, much of my life might be habitual. You know, even though I'm kind of just doing, I'm not doing a ritual, much of my mental activity is very often habitual. Then the question is, how do you break habit? And that's very hard. And then ritual can be a particular way, but it can become just another habit, no doubt about that. So like much of Buddhism is developing skillful means, called upaya, skillful methods, skillful means, skillful thoughts, skillful rituals, you know, and this is very personal work and a very creative work in that sense, that each person has to. That's why it's the beauty of Buddhism, says you don't have to do this. You don't have to do it. But it can find a place. It's the key. That reflective mind is the key. And I always think if a person believes they're brain dead, they're roughly put. Because if I believe in Buddhism, I'm finished. But if I use the Buddhist way and I question and I look deeply, then I go to confidence of knowing the way things are. And so again, I don't think it's the tradition, it's how it's being put across. So if you get a very kind of contemplatively, you know, like someone like Merton or someone like that, who's really, have you read New Seeds of Contemplation? That was a very powerful book. I mean, it really, really poking you in the heart. I found it really inspiring. I didn't understand basically much of what he was talking about, Merton, because I don't understand the Christian language, say. But I sensed the kind of questioning and aspiration in the man's mind, and that just that I found very inspiring. So it's how these things are put across, I think, yeah. And Buddhism, the jnana traditions, the kind of wisdom traditions, use questioning. They really use that, but not just in an intellectual way. They use it in a way of, like one philosopher says, you can't get an intellectual. What you can do with thought is bring the mind to the sense of not knowing, to the sense of the question. And then you have to hold that mind in the purity of not knowing. And so like the Korean tradition use what? What? I met a nun who had been for 7 years, her practice was what? What's that about? And if you take a question, you say, what's this moment like? And don't answer that, and just hold a mind. Your mind's very receptive, very attentive, very pure, actually. As soon as you try to get an answer, well, it's hot, it's cold, it's big, it's small, I like it, I don't like it, you're caught up in intellect again. So many Buddhist schools use that ability to bring the mind to the sense of that poised attention with doubt. Yes? Can you define God for me? Christians have so many definitions about that. Can you give me a definition? Because I'm not being facetious. I've just heard so many definitions of God that before I'd enter into that dialogue, I'd need a definition.
Well, a God with a personality,
separate,
yes,
out there,
yes,
that form of Christianity would go against Buddhism, the Buddhist, but there are forms of Christianity where God is no thing and is not separate. Then you start to enter into the way that the Buddhists talk about. So it's very, that in this kind of dialogue, it's very important to get that down. What are we talking about when we say, like, the word God? And then you get the definition and work from that definition. Because I've heard some, I was just listening to a tape of a teacher called Raimondo Panikkar, who's a Benedictine monk, and he uses a lot of Hindu ideas and Buddhist ideas and Christian ideas, and I had no disagreement with him. But then if I talked to a Jehovah's Witness, I got a lot of disagreements. So I think this is so when you say we don't have a personal God in that sense, some archetypal figure out there who's kind of overlooking us, we don't have that. But then to say that the Christianity is saying there's many ways to interpret Christianity. Not that I want to be an apologist to Christianity, but I mean, I have heard things which are different than that. But it is different that way. So Buddha isn't a God for us. You know, it's both a human being who realized, and then his body died, and also the potential that we have for that same kind of realization. Yeah. Not in the physical sense. No, not in the kind of, no. One of the things we say, what happens to a Buddha on death, we don't know. It's too difficult to figure out. But like the Buddha says, when you see the truth, you see me. When you see me, you see the truth. So he equated himself to truth. So then you get into the kind of transcendent language of religion, which is different than just the historical language. So it's a historical person, this person died. But then the spiritual transcendent realization is, we say, the deathless in Buddhism. That's the way we talk. There is the deathless, there is the unconditioned, the uncreated. And that realization is possible for all. Now, what happens to individuality in that realization? I think we'd have to have another lecture for that one, or another 20 lectures. I mean, it's a very interesting problem or question to go into. So we tend to not... we don't tend to kind of... we either see the Buddha as the person, or we see it as that principle of enlightenment, which is possible to all of us. But it's not dualistic in that sense. Okay. Yes? Commitment's the important thing, and commitment is a type of mind state, isn't it? And then what you're looking for are supports for that commitment. And anything that can support you in that commitment helps you. So if you find rituals don't help you in the commitment, then don't use them. But if you find rituals helpful at whatever degree, less or more, then you use them. So if you always use that, it's an aid or a support in the commitment, you know, then you'll figure out your own way. And you can figure out your own rituals or your own signs or whatever. But if you do it the other way around, you put the cart before the horse. Yeah. Proportion
of
ritual to 60-40, 20-80. It depends on who you are. Like, if a person who has a really devotional bhakti kind of mind, for them to do 10 minutes of chanting could, you know, really elevate the mind and to make it really strong for meditation. But another person who doesn't have a kind of bhakti mind and has a more janani mind, more kind of wisdom mind, might not like that. So it really depends on character and what works. So if ritual and chanting doesn't work, you know, no problem.
So it's really, you know, you just kind of see. And then also times, you know, at times, like sometimes people, I've seen people who just, their life is going really, really rotten, and all they do is chanting. And it's brilliant, because they can't meditate. Their mind's just in a mess. Life's a mess, and they just chant. And because they have a devotional heart, they have a way of channeling that energy. Other people just meditate and look at their mind. Sometimes when they can't keep it together, as it were, if their mind is very kind of intellectual and controlled in that way, they haven't got a devotional avenue, so they're at a disadvantage. See, so it really depends on your character. So if you, you know, if chanting brings up cynicism and negativity, well, don't do it, because that's not a wholesome mind state. But don't assume that because it that's for you, that's for everyone. You know, each one of us has a kind of different way we relate to those things. So now the thing about Buddhism, it doesn't get into absolutes about this. That's the beauty, you know. It's not like we're not taking a position that rituals are necessary. That's the danger of Western mind. It gets very absolutist and positionist. We take a position. Rituals are good. I'm not saying that. Or we take a position, rituals are bad. I'm not saying that either. Rituals are tools. So we needn't take a position and just see, kind of basically, does it work? In a kind of pragmatic way, that way.
Rituals do encourage, there's a form to arise of self as craving. The person is doing the ritual to gain good merit or karma. And it indirectly must can encourage that by going on answering. The person giving the food thinking that it's a selfish craving coming up.
Yeah, but you've been in Thailand and those people that gave me rice, I don't think they had any, they just loved doing it. I don't think they're so intellectual, actually. Yeah, I think we get really intellectual and we lay that kind of intellectual projection onto it. Like the people in Northeast Thailand, they just love doing it. They give them so much joy giving alms food. So I saw the merit right there, in the sense that their mind came to merit, yeah. But, I mean, it's possible. I mean, I'm not saying that's not possible, but don't take it that absolutely, that there's both ways to look at that. Like we go alms round here on a big festival. You know, we have 1,000 people putting a little bit of rice in our bowl. I mean, how many are thinking there? I'm going to make merit. Grubby merit. I mean, I don't think people are doing that. I think they're just great. Let's put some food in the monk's bowl. It's quite direct and simple. It's not really so complicated. You might get some, you know, kind of bandit Chinese businessman in Bangkok who's just made it. A big deal with China, and he says, "God, I'm really feeling guilty. I think I'll build a temple or something." Like, okay, you might get that. But anyway, in general, because I've seen that, I've seen the generosity of Asian people is just astounding, and the joy they get from that. And I do see that something that's grown in the culture. Also, what I like, not that Asian society is perfect, but I like the sense of innocence sometimes I find in Asian cultures. You know, the cynicism of Western culture, I find, in my own self, is very defeating of joy. Where it's just that spontaneous giving of like, you know, in Ajahn Chah's monasteries around there. Wow, I found it very, very uplifting. But you can make a case for it, you know. There can be self-view there. I'm making merit and so on. Guy, like Thailand, the alms round was one best time of day. You know, I just finished, you know, because in Thailand there's nothing to do except meditate. And, you know, in the early years, the last thing you want to do is meditate. You're just going to try to survive and think, when am I going to get a cup of coffee or something? And then in the morning, I'd go on an alms round. It was so uplifting. It's such a kind of joyous experience. Because this whole society had this ritual where I went out, I was reminded of my life of mendicancy. Lay people put food in my bowl. When they're putting food in my bowl, they're saying, go for it. Basically, that's what I always felt. They said, "Good on you, you know, keep going. Don't lose heart." And that was, you know, for me, it was actually very uplifting. Kept me going. I think they felt like in Thailand, you could see they had that sense of respect for anyone who was really trying to do the work because they found it difficult themselves. So it was for me, it was a very uplifting kind of process. Also fed me. Any else? Yes. There you go, yeah. And you didn't think about it, did you? It just felt great, yeah. Yeah. That the boundaries create safety.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a good one. Well, if you, I mean, there are teachings which are very direct, which, you know, don't have a form around them. Okay, so maybe something like Krishnamurti, maybe something like that. So for me, religion does imply a vehicle. I don't have the absolute definition of that. For me, it does imply a kind of various kinds of skillful means, liturgies, chanting, all of that. But it doesn't mean that liberation is necessarily through a religious vehicle. You see, there's sort of other possibilities. So the closest to non-ritualistic practice is, you know, like Advaita Vedanta. Things like Ramana Maharshini or Nisargadatta, just very, very direct, pointing at the mind. Very, very direct, yeah? Whereas if you look like a Tibetan Buddhism, it's much more ornate than Theravada. You know, like for me, Tibetan Buddhism is like I see it as a kind of Lococo, or, you know, and ours is more like shaker furniture. Yeah. So whatever you like, but so. Different cultures develop it in different ways. But that was interesting too, like, yeah, we're just reflecting what you said, that it does create community by doing something together. It does, I think, help. I think you're right. It creates, it helps in that sense of separation and alienation. It does help, you know, we're doing this work together. And Sangha is like the community of spiritual friends is one of the most important things in the spiritual life. To help you keep going.
That create barriers.
It can create barriers, but it doesn't necessarily have to. Yeah, you. Yeah. Yeah, you can get this kind of in-group. You know, I know how to do ETP so, and you don't. I keep the five precepts. So human ego is just such a wicked thing, isn't it? It's just, it just creeps in everywhere. Yes? So how did that feel for you? How did it feel for you?
For me, I just think, well, things will change. I don't like that.
So the first thing, you know, you come into a place and you have a ritual in place. And it's the way the structure is organized through history and time. Now, as a reflective and contemplative person, it is important for you to look at that. Not to say it's right or wrong, but to see how your mind is conditioned around that. And to see that your conditioning, your perception is not absolute truth. Because an Asian person comes in and they have no problem with that. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but first of all, to see, you know, in a religious vehicle, you're traveling in the vehicle and you get certain reactions. of like and dislike. The thing about a religious vehicle, you'll never find a perfect vehicle. You know, Volkswagen or Rolls Royce, they've got their imperfections. And so then you're going to have certain kinds of reactions to that. And the secret, I think, of the religious vehicle is, first of all, that everyone is cared for. And you know, so that you have to look at. If there is a hierarchy, does that mean that there's is it a demeaning hierarchy? Now, then you have to ask the people in the hierarchy if they find it demeaning. You can't project that onto them and say, this is demeaning. You have to kind of ask them and so on. Does everyone get requisites? You know? Does everyone have the opportunity to practice? Does everyone get teaching? These are kind of very, very important issues. Then you have to look at the historical context of a tradition and where it's coming from. Coming from, you know, different cultural contexts. And then you have to, say, look at the community and see within that context, what are they doing? How are they using that tradition? The thing about a tradition, it carries in time. You know, it has this way of carrying through time. So around the male hierarchy, I have no answer. That's historically how it's come about. And this is where we're at now, and I don't want to get into praising or blaming it, because then it's kind of, you know, justifying it and so on. But if you want to change it, you have to shave your head. Yeah, because if you really want to change it, you have to get in there and work. Because you can't come from the outside and say, I want this changed, without putting your heart and soul into it. If you put your heart and soul into it, if you have the faith, then you can work for change. You know, then you can work for change, and that's what. So what you have to do is you have to talk to the sisters and see, you know, how do they feel about those issues, and what's happening for change, if you know, whatever changes you might feel are necessary. Because I don't want to get into kind of justifying and all of that, because it's a very kind of complex issue. We lie between the conservatism of Asia and the liberality of Western cultures. We're the kind of in between, and so we consider these issues a lot. You know, we really think about them a lot. But my most important thing is there an environment of practice and contemplation for everyone. For men and women. Like also authority and hierarchy. There's a difference between being authoritarian and authoritative. Can you see that? There is a difference. For me, authoritarian is using power in an egotistical way. Authoritative can be just a proper leadership. So, like you see, like the very idea of hierarchy and authority can sound, like in Western culture, to be a bad thing. So the kind of language of our culture tends to be egalitarian. But it's not, you know, like there is egalitarian, but there is also hierarchy. And then you have the monks are senior to the nuns, which is a historical precedent, which has come through our tradition. And to some extent, that's the way it is. You know? To really change that, I don't think the nuns will ever be senior to the monks. I just don't see how that could be possible in the history of. If you started a new order, you could. And then some people have done that. They said, well, we do it so, some traditions have it differently, and they've done it differently. They've created different vehicles. And any vehicle you come into, you're going to have those limitations. And so, you take that on board. And if you're going to practice in the vehicle, so that's the way it is. And then there has to be a certain amount of working with what one likes or dislikes about a vehicle. So I certainly, there's lots of things that I don't like about the vehicle. And that's one of them. You know, I don't necessarily like that. I would feel much more comfortable if it was different in Western culture. Yeah. But my personal preference, it's interesting, my personal preferences are really not that important, because this thing is bigger than me. Yeah? And so one has to kind of and get a feeling for the complexity. Very complex issue, a difficult issue. So I didn't really answer your question, I suppose. It's a lot of things there. Oh, they're always equal. They always have a chance for enlightenment. And then, you know, some nuns are much more attained than the monks. See, there's a difference between... I mean, I ask them lots of questions. I mean, we have lots of, like, we have a... We call it Amaravati Steering Committee, where we make decisions about what to do, and we always do it in consultation with each other. So I think it works very, very well. But, you know, just because I'm senior to like, even a monk, doesn't mean that I'm more wise than them. You know, there's been lots of young monks who have come in, I felt much more together than I am. But that's the interesting thing about a hierarchy, which is from, like, a hierarchy of not of attainment or personality, but a hierarchy which is based on history. So like I'm senior because I historically came in before Shradan, who's doing, you know, and if Shradan becomes a monk or whatever, he'll never be senior to me, even if he gets enlightened. Even if he's enlightened and I'm dribbling my gruel on my sweater, he'll still bow to me, won't you? And that's interesting, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to de-emphasize personality, and we're just sort of trying to plug into this. And so, like, charisma and attainment aren't so important as just like a vehicle. All right? Yes. I think it chooses you. I don't know. It just kind of hit me. I think I was walking across the road and I got run over by it. I don't, yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I was looking for a form because I had the kind of insights. I was looking for a form and a form came along. Maybe that, you know, maybe you're kind of ripe and then something. Yeah, I don't, that's a good guess. It's a real spiritual supermarket now. No easy answer. Pick one that you can think for yourself. Pick one that's moral. Pick one where you know that the people around live their teaching. Pick one which opens you to all beings rather than closes you off to your own group. Pick one that makes you happy. Pick one that challenges you and makes you work. If you can get a teacher who's willing to support you and challenge you, great. And these kinds of things are very helpful. But I think the essence is morality, meditation and reflection, and the ability to use the doubting, questioning mind. That's the... So again, if it's just a belief structure, I mean, you might as well just read a book. That quality of the human mind which can investigate and ponder, that's really what you want. So if someone is just telling you have to believe this, then I don't think it's going to be that useful. You'll have a nice belief structure, but, and you can argue with other belief structures. They won't really liberate you. All right. So we might as well close there. Thank you.